The sun is calling. Are you ready? From beach days to soccer plays, Blue Lizard Australian Sunscreen helps protect your family's skin so you can focus on the fun, not the sun. With no fragrances, parabens, or phthalates, our mineral sunscreen is designed for your sensitive skin and trusted by dermatologists, pediatricians, and parents alike. Be fearless in the sun with Blue Lizard Australian Sunscreen. Shop now on Amazon.com.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. October 1st, 1976, a sunny afternoon in San Diego, California. Lefteria Özbun, everyone called her Lisa, was 33 years old, a Turkish immigrant and mother of three who had just ended her shift at a clothing manufacturer where she worked as a seamstress. It was a slow day at work, so she was sent home more than 2 hours early. This would have been better news if Lisa had had a car, but she and her husband Darwin shared, and Darwin was at his own job. He wasn't set to pick her up until 5 p.m. To kill time waiting for Darwin, Lisa took a bus to go to a shopping center and then circled back to the designated meeting spot where she expected her husband was already waiting for her. As she made her way through a supermarket parking lot, the sun still shining, a car U-turned and blocked her path. A man jumped out. Dark glasses covered half his face. Lisa wasn't alarmed at first, but then she saw a knife in his hand. The man forced Lisa into his car, taped her hands behind her back, and growled, "Don't say nothing. Don't you try to scream. I'm going to cut your throat right now." Lisa trembled as they drove away, the knife at her side. The driver said, "I'm going to take your damn money and I'm going to stick a knife in you." Years later, Lisa would tell the Los Angeles Times what she remembered about the man's eyes in that moment. Quote, "I'd never seen eyes like that. They were so cold and filled with hate. I knew if I didn't fight, I'd never see my kids again." End quote. So she fought. As he drove away with her in the car, she struggled. She kicked and thrashed so hard that she managed to bash a hole in the windshield of the moving car. Then she flung her body toward her assailant, hitting both the steering wheel and the brake pedal. He slapped her so hard she felt dizzy. Then he stabbed her in the stomach. The blade pierced her liver and went so deep that Lisa couldn't see the 6-inch blade. Only the handles stuck out from her diaphragm. Still, she fought, struggling to grip the wheel with her taped hands. She managed to hit the car horn. Other drivers couldn't help but notice the swerving, honking car barreling erratically down the street. Finally, the car jerked to a stop, and Lisa managed to maneuver the passenger door open. The knife was still jutting from her as she fell to the ground. The driver paused for a moment, as if in shock, and then sped away. Lisa Özbun survived. A witness who had been watching managed to write down the license plate of this speeding car. The car was registered to a woman named Paige Smith. She was wife number two of a man who had made international headlines when, just 5 years earlier, he had been released from prison and heralded by William F. Buckley Jr., as a wrongfully convicted man. Now, Edgar Herbert Smith Jr. was on the run. And this time, there would be no brilliant legal team, no champagne toasts, no literary giants in his corner. This time, the truth would finally come out. This is the second half of the story of how one of America's most prominent intellectuals was fooled by a murderer, how a prestigious book editor fell for a death row inmate through letters how the literary establishment of New York championed a killer because he could write pretty well, and how a 15-year-old girl named Victoria Zielinski became a footnote in the story of the man who killed her. It's about who gets believed, who gets remembered, and what happens when celebrity advocacy collides with brutal truth. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Quince. Luxury bedding is one of those things you don't fully appreciate until you actually sleep in it. I've been using Quince sheets for years now, and I genuinely don't want to go back.
It was noticeable immediately. They feel like hotel sheets.
Exactly. Quince has European linen that gets softer with each wash, organic cotton that feels really substantial without being heavy, and breathable bamboo that stays cool. They also have quilts, comforters, duvet inserts, basically everything you need to make your bed the best part of your day.
And they just dropped new seasonal colors and patterns. Stripes, florals. I saw that butter yellow.
You did? You were like, ooh, butter yellow?
Yeah, so?
When I crawl into bed now, it feels like a luxury hotel, but it costs 50 to 60% less.
That's because they partner directly with manufacturers and skip the markup. No middlemen, no fancy packaging.
You're already sleeping in your bed every night? You might as well love it. Right now, get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns when you go to quince.com/centuries. That's a full year to decide if you love them, and honestly, you will. Now available in Canada, too. Don't wait on this. Go to quince.com/centuries for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/centuries. Last episode, part one of this two-parter, we ended with Edgar Smith walking out of that New Jersey courthouse a free man in December 1971, championed by William F. Buckley Jr. But to understand how we got there and what happened next, we need to back up to 1965, 6 years before Edgar's release. This is where a very different relationship began, one that would prove just as important to Edgar's freedom as Buckley's advocacy. Sophie Wilkins was in her 50s when she read William F. Buckley's Esquire article about Edgar Smith. She was exceptionally well-credentialed, having studied under the renowned literary critic Lionel Trilling at Columbia University. But Sophie was struggling. She worked as an editor at Alfred A. Knopf, a very waspy publishing house where, as Sarah Weinman says, she had varying success. Her professional life wasn't where she had hoped it would be by this stage of her career, and her personal life was even messier.
So, from her standpoint, editing a book by Edgar Smith, making the case that he's innocent, this could be a real career maker. But, you know, she has enough boundary issues and mental health issues.
Sophie was married to her third husband, a man who was severely mentally ill. The marriage was difficult. She would eventually divorce him and later reconnect with a man she had known in her 20s, the love of her life, the one who got away. But in 1965, she still hadn't found him yet. She was struggling professionally and personally and was vulnerable and emotionally primed for something, though what that something would turn out to be, she couldn't have imagined. When Sophie read Buckley's 12,000-word piece about Edgar Smith and Esquire, she saw opportunity. Here was a brilliant, articulate man on death row, maintaining his innocence, fighting for his life. Here was a story that could become an important book. A death row inmate's account of wrongful conviction, of the fight for justice in an American courtroom. Sophie believed passionately in the topic, so she wrote to Buckley. Great piece, really fascinating. Maybe there's a book in it? Buckley was intrigued. He put Sophie in touch with Edgar's lawyers. Eventually, the idea made its way to Edgar himself. By 1967, Sophie Wilkins and Edgar Smith had begun their own correspondence. At first, it was entirely professional, an editor and her potential author working on what could be a significant book. Sophie asked editorial questions, Edgar provided answers. They discussed structure, narrative, evidence. But Edgar Smith was a savvy, cunning manipulator, and he picked up on something very quickly. Sophie was oversharing. She was revealing personal details in her letters, expressing emotions that went beyond the professional. She was lonely, she was struggling, and she was treating Edgar like a confidant. So Edgar started doing the same thing. He mirrored her vulnerability. He became whatever she seemed to need him to be. Within just 2 or 3 rounds of correspondence, there was a shift. The letters became more personal, more intimate, and then they became something else entirely. In early 2016, Weinman was researching what would become her book, Scoundrel. She was following the usual trails, archives, libraries, old newspaper clippings. She found a reference to papers that Sophie Wilkins had donated to Columbia University before her death. Sarah made an appointment to visit Columbia's rare book and manuscript library. She expected to find some professional correspondence between a book editor and her author. Maybe some editorial notes, maybe some discussion of the manuscript for the book of Edgar's she would edit, which ultimately was titled Brief Against Death.
And in about 10 minutes, I found the smut. Imagine I'm sitting on the, you know, in the Rare Books and Manuscripts Library of Columbia University. There's maybe 1 or 2 other people, archivists and other researchers around. It's sometime in the morning on a weekday. I'm reading this going, oh my God. Oh my God, I'm going to go like this. Because I just cannot believe what I'm reading in this rarefied era.
The letters between Edgar Smith and Sophie Wilkins became sexually explicit. They became romantic. They assigned each other nicknames. She was often Owl or Red, the latter in honor of her hair color, and he was Igor, a nickname his brother had given him, which Sophie eventually morphed into Ilya, a Russian variation that could also be shorthand for I love you. Edgar was seducing his editor through the mail, and Sophie, intelligent, educated, accomplished Sophie, fell hard for it. Edgar smuggled the most explicit of the letters to Sophie through his lawyers. The correspondence became an affair conducted entirely on paper, a deeply inappropriate relationship between a death row inmate and the editor who was helping him write a book about his wrongful conviction. At one point, Sophie noticed something and flagged it in a letter to Edgar. The letters he sent William F. Buckley were completely different from the letters he sent to her. She wanted to hear more of the Edgar who wrote to Buckley, the intellectual, the serious thinker, the man engaged with philosophy and legal theory. What she didn't recognize at the time was that Edgar was code-switching, tailoring his persona to his audience. It was masterful manipulation. And it worked. Through 1967, Sophie edited Edgar's manuscript. The book at first was to be called Murder in Mahwah, but Knopf insisted on a title change in hopes of broadening its appeal outside of New Jersey. That's how it became Brief Against Death, and it made a compelling case for Edgar's innocence. It detailed the flaws in his trial, the confession obtained after hours without sleep and without counsel, the circumstantial physical evidence, the questionable timeline, the alternate suspect who had been dismissed too quickly. The book made a splash, earning positive reviews nationwide from newspaper literary critics. Remember those? In a syndicated column titled The Literary Lantern, Hugh Stevens wrote, quote, "One cannot possibly read Brief Against Death without developing an intense respect for Smith's knowledge and application of the technical intricacies of criminal law and for his self-taught literary skills. This former Marine, this high school dropout, this convicted killer, whatever he has been or may yet be, is certainly an extraordinary man." End quote. And to get the book into publishable form, the editing process was by no means smooth. He and Sophie were navigating an awfully convoluted relationship.
She sees an early drafts of chapters, and then they're still going on this parallel epistolary entanglement. And then there's a breach, because once the book is getting ready to go through publication, there's copy editing. Copy editor wants big changes. Edgar freaks out. He takes it out on Sophie. She's like, what? You know, she complains to Buckley, is this guy psycho?
Side note, people, it's a red flag if you feel the need to ask that about any potential romantic partner, especially one who's been convicted of murder. Just saying. Sophie and Edgar patched things up, but the relationship was never quite the same after that. The inappropriate intimacy and sexual correspondence tapered off. By the time Grief Against Death was actually published in 1968, Sophie and Edgar were no longer as close as they had been at the height of their letter-writing affair. But the book got the attention that Sophie had hoped for. Buckley wrote the introduction. He went on The Tonight Show to promote it. He wrote more columns. The campaign to free Edgar Smith was gaining serious momentum. They even tried to get Truman Capote involved. Capote, after all, had written In Cold Blood, this seminal true crime book about two murderers on death row in Kansas. Surely he'd be interested in Edgar's case. Capote did read Grief Against Death. His response was blunt. Quote, "I still think he's guilty as hell, so I don't know if I can do a blurb, but I might want to write about it." End quote. Buckley and Sophie were totally on board with that. They figured it would be better to get an article in the press than a blurb on a book jacket anyway. Capote's article never materialized, but the book still became a bestseller. More than that, it convinced people. And not everyone. Plenty of people still thought Edgar was guilty, including prosecutors in New Jersey and, obviously, Vicky Zelinsky's family. But enough people. Important people. The case was becoming a cause célèbre. And behind the scenes, Edgar's lawyers, an elite legal team retained and paid for by Buckley, who managed the royalties coming in from Brief Against Death, were filing appeal after appeal after appeal. About 20 appeals in total. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by ButcherBox. Dinner time hits fast around here, and if I don't have a plan, it's chaos. That's why I keep coming back to ButcherBox. I've used them many times, and it just makes life easier.
Also, you've turned into the neighborhood protein dealer.
I have, absolutely, shared ButcherBox ribs and chicken with neighbors. No regrets. The quality is just consistently good. They deliver over 100 premium protein options straight to your door, 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, crate-free pork, wild-caught seafood.
And everything meets the same standards, right? Whether it's a filet or a chicken nugget.
I'm actually planning to make a couple of their steaks to prove to you that steak doesn't have to be tough.
I remain skeptical.
That's because you haven't had the right one. And I love that we can customize the box depending on what we're cooking that month. Plus, every box ships free always.
As an exclusive offer, new listeners can get their choice between organic ground beef, chicken breast, or ground turkey in every box for a year, plus $20 off when you go to butcherbox.com/COTC.
That's right, your choice of organic ground beef, chicken breast, or ground turkey in every box for a year, plus $20 off your first box and free shipping always. That's butcherbox.com/COTC. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, the legal landscape was changing in America, and Edgar Smith's case was perfectly positioned to benefit from those changes. Under Chief Justice Earl Warren, the Supreme Court had begun what legal scholars call the Criminal Procedure Revolution, a series of landmark decisions that dramatically expanded the rights of criminal defendants and placed new restrictions on police power. Cases that had seemed like no-brainers in 1957 were now riddled with constitutional issues. In 1966, the Supreme Court decided Miranda v. Arizona, requiring police to inform suspects of their rights before interrogation. In re Gault extended due process rights to juveniles. The court was systematically examining how police obtained confessions and what made those confessions valid. Edgar's confession, obtained with no lawyer, with press watching, after nearly 20 hours of questioning, suddenly looked a lot more problematic than it had seemed in 1957. Here's Buckley and Smith talking about how the duration of questioning ultimately played into a judge overturning Smith's conviction.
The crime is, say, midnight one day. At 11 o'clock the next night, the police come and they take you in for questioning.
Yes.
At 10 o'clock the next morning is the cutoff point as far as the federal courts were concerned, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Now, what is the meaning of that?
Anything after 10 o'clock was inadmissible.
On the grounds that at that point you had been overtaxed?
At that point, that is the point at which the judge felt that the coercive influence had been so great that anything after that would be inadmissible.
And then there was the lawyer issue.
I should also be warned about certain rights, but in 1957, that was not a requirement, that was not mandatory. They didn't have to warn you. The Miranda rule didn't exist.
The public was, and it should be noted, still is, in favor of those changes. Nearly one-third of exonerations between 1989 and 2020 involved false confessions, according to the Innocence Project. Author Weinman.
Unfortunately, I think almost every case pre-Miranda, and certainly many, many cases post-Miranda, should be overturned just on bad procedure and bad interrogations and coerced confessions.
In June of 1971, federal judge John Joseph Gibbons ruled that Edgar Smith's confession had been involuntary and coerced by police. Despite multiple previous judges over 14 years determining that the confession was voluntary, Gibbons vacated the 1957 conviction and ordered a new trial. The confession would be excluded from evidence. The state of New Jersey now faced a difficult decision. They could retry a 14-year-old murder case without the confession, but the witnesses had scattered, memories had faded, and the case would be much, much harder to prove now. Or they could offer Edgar a deal. They offered him second-degree murder. Plead guilty to the lesser charge and get credit for time served, 14 years and 9 months, plus good behavior credit. He would walk out of prison immediately, that day. Before accepting the plea deal, Judge Morris Poshman did something important. He examined the case thoroughly himself. He read Brief Against Death. He reviewed the trial transcripts. And he arranged for Edgar to be examined by a psychiatrist of his own choosing, Dr. Ralph Brancale. The doctor's evaluation would prove to be spectacularly, tragically wrong. After examining Edgar Smith, Dr. Brancale concluded that he was a changed man. Prison had rehabilitated him. He had spent 14 years reading, writing, thinking. He had become introspective and thoughtful. Brancale wrote in his report, quote, "There is nothing in the personality pattern that would suggest the probability of a recurring similar offense or that manifests other antisocial behavior. The prospects for the future are good," end quote. On December 6, 1971, Edgar Smith stood before Judge Poshman in that Bergen County Courthouse in Hackensack, told the judge he and he alone had killed Vicki Zelinsky, and then he walked out a free man. We covered that moment in last week's episode, the limousines, the champagne, the taping of firing line, the triumph. William F. Buckley had staked his considerable reputation on Edgar Smith's innocence, and now Edgar was free. It seemed like vindication. But of course, Edgar maintained, to Buckley, to reporters, to anyone who would listen, that he had only said yes to gain his freedom. That after nearly 15 years on death row, the longest anyone in American history had spent there at that time, he would have said anything to walk out of that courtroom. The question was, did anyone really believe that? Or did they just want to believe it? At one point on firing line, Buckley asked Edgar an interesting question.
Is it your intention to try to find the killer now?
I don't think it's possible. I think this is one of those crimes that only the person who did it knows. And I don't think it will be possible after all this time, with so many people who have died, to really ever find the answer.
Vicki Zelinsky was in the past. Edgar Smith was free. And for a brief moment, he was almost famous. He became a sought-after speaker on prison reform and criminal justice. He appeared on talk shows and gave lengthy radio interviews. He wrote op-eds for the New York Times. He reviewed books for Playboy. He was the living embodiment of a second chance, proof that the criminal justice system could correct its mistakes and that an innocent man, if he fought hard enough, could win his freedom. William F. Buckley hosted a party for Edgar at his Upper East Side maisonette. Edgar was now moving in the same circles as Buckley, which meant rubbing shoulders with the conservative establishment, intellectuals, wealthy donors, people who mattered in New York society. Edgar was still writing, too. In between Brief Against Death's release and Edgar's release, he had published two novels. Both were, by most accounts, not great. But hey, it's hard writing books, especially fiction, and the meager book sales had still helped pay his lawyers, so I'm not judging. After his release, however, he returned to his nonfiction roots. In 1973, he published Getting Out, which picked up where Brief Against Death left off and detailed more about his prison experience and his fight for freedom. Even Buckley thought it was crap. The book didn't sell well. The writing assignments began to dry up. But the cracks had started showing even before the literary failures.
One of Buckley's staffers told me about essentially being menaced by Smith in the office, and she felt like she had to get away from him.
It always seemed to be women who found him unnerving.
He had a girlfriend, again, that she was writing him in prison, and when he got out, they were trying to figure out if they had like an IRL relationship. She had two kids, and she went with him on a car ride, and she was like, he's acting so strangely, and she felt terrified and broke off the relationship.
As for Sophie Wilkins, by the time Edgar got out of prison, they were barely in contact. She did invite him to come visit Knopf's offices after his release, just as she was leaving the company. He promised he would, but never showed up. Whatever had existed between them existed only on paper, and once Edgar was free, he had no use for it anymore. He lived like he was making up for lost time. He bought a big fancy car, moved into a luxury apartment building in Ridgefield Park, and became a regular at a local bowling alley. That's where he met his second wife, a woman named Paige. She was about 19 years old, the same age his first wife had been when he married her nearly 20 years prior. Edgar and Paige moved to San Diego, California. Fresh start, new city, far from New Jersey and New York, and the shadow of Victoria Zelinsky. It didn't work. Edgar cycled through what one account called a series of crummy jobs. The speaking engagements had already dried up, as did the freelance writing assignments. Paige worked as a nurse, and her income was keeping them afloat, but money was tight. Edgar needed cash. The rage returned. And in fairness, it surely never left. It had always been there, simmering beneath the surface, even back when he was a teenager, exposing himself to a 9-year-old girl on the eve of her birthday. Sometimes, when it served him, Edgar was able to contain the rage. Sometimes he wasn't. His marriage with Paige was violent and unhappy. He sexually abused his young wife. She was inexperienced enough that she didn't appreciate what she had endured until decades later. She said nothing at the time. Edgar stayed in touch with Buckley, but the relationship was strained. He only seemed to reach out when he needed money. At one point, Buckley had to pay off some of Edgar's debts just to make the problem go away. They had a falling out. They patched things up later, sort of, but it was never the same. In 1975, Edgar wrote a letter to Buckley. The letter, in hindsight, reads like a warning, or maybe a confession waiting to happen. Edgar wrote, quote, I am out west. I have a young wife. I'm having trouble getting work. I'm in debt. This feels a lot like 1957, end quote. An old pattern was returning. The same circumstances, the same pressures, the same rage, looking for an outlet. We're back to October 1st, 1976. This is less than 5 years after William F. Buckley had picked Edgar Smith up in a limousine outside that New Jersey courthouse. Edgar was stinging from a new rejection.
He has attempted to try to get a job at the San Diego Union Tribune. It does not go well.
Incensed he didn't get the job, he decided to do something with his rage. Something familiar. I'm sure Lisa Osboon spent the rest of her life ruminating the what-ifs. What if her boss hadn't let her out early from work that day? What if she had killed time a different way? Could she have made another choice that would have diverted her path just enough to avoid ever encountering Edgar Smith? It's a miracle she survived. The knife he rammed into her abdomen had narrowly missed her vital organs. She was lucky, too, that a witness had the wherewithal to write down the fleeing car's license plate. After police discovered the car was registered to Paige Smith, they had no doubts. They immediately began searching for Edgar. He knew they would. He ran. On October 7th, 1976, the LA Times ran a story headlined, "Jailhouse author, lawyer, sought in kidnapping." It began, quote, "Edgar H. Smith, 42, famed as a jailhouse author and lawyer during his 14 years for the bludgeon murder of a high school cheerleader, was accused today of kidnapping and stabbing a woman in Chula Vista last week." End quote. As of that story, written days after the attack, Lisa Osboon was still hospitalized with her injuries. But she was recovering and was certain she could identify her assailant. For nearly 2 weeks, Edgar Smith was a fugitive. He stayed briefly with an old editor who had given him writing assignments back when he was still a literary curiosity, you know, still marketable.
He was in Brooklyn for part of the time, and eventually he makes his way to Vegas, and that's when he calls Buckley's office. Buckley doesn't pick up. It's his secretary, Frances Bronson. She picks up. She realizes who it is. She improvises that Buckley is away on travel. He's not. After Edgar hangs up, she tells Buckley, "What should we do?" Buckley's like, "I'm going to call the FBI."
And Buckley did. He called the FBI, who made their way to Edgar's hotel, where he had checked himself in under a false name. By the way, if you were inclined to give Edgar the benefit of the doubt here, don't. He did not call Buckley intending to turn himself in. He actually told Bronson that he desperately needed help because he'd been mugged, see, and lost all his money. Luckily, Buckley didn't buy his story this time. The FBI arrested Edgar, who was charged with kidnapping, intent to rob, and attempted murder. This time, Edgar Smith was on his own. After the arrest, reporters, of course, tried to get Buckley to talk. He repeatedly declined. Weinman found a letter he penned to Edgar's mother in which he wrote, quote, "The newspapers keep calling about Edgar, but really, what is there to say? When the probation officer from California called me to ask the ritual questions, she arrived at the fifth. In your opinion, is the detainee reliable and trustworthy for purposes of bail?" Strange question to ask under the circumstances. Of course, I had to reply in the negative, but rather resented being asked it at all. End quote. Buckley finally wrote publicly about the turn of events in his syndicated On the Right column in November 1976, more than a month after the attack. He said, in that stodgy, pedantic way of his, that he now believed Edgar, the man he had long championed, had been guilty of Vicky's murder all along. Quote, "There is no mechanism as yet perfected that will establish beyond question a person's guilt or innocence. There will be guilty people freed this year and every year. But for those who believe that the case of Edgar Smith warrants a vow to accept the ruling of a court as always definitive, it is only necessary to remind ourselves that, this year and every year, an innocent man will be convicted. Edgar Smith has done quite enough damage in his lifetime without underwriting the doctrine that the verdict of a court is infallible." End quote. I mean, I agree with him on those points, but with an asterisk. It is far easier to convict an innocent person than it is to reverse the conviction of someone who's been found guilty, even if they are truly innocent. I work in this field. Edgar Smith is an anomaly. Anyway, the trial began in the spring of 1977 in San Diego. Writers nationwide paid attention. One wrote about how he had attended the 1971 hearing, the one during which Edgar admitted killing Zelinsky and walked away a free man, and how he had known in his gut back then that the man was guilty. Joe Piccioni wrote, quote, "I didn't like Edgar Smith one bit. I didn't like the way he leaned against the wall, looking smug and flicking ashes on the polished floor. I began feeling a tremendous sympathy for a young girl who had been clubbed to death nearly 15 years before," end quote. And whether he truly felt that at the time or just in hindsight is hard to say. I couldn't find a story written by him in 1971. Regardless, he paid rapt attention to the second trial in 1977. The evidence against Edgar was even more damning the second time around. Lisa Osboon took the stand and described in detail what Edgar had done to her. Her testimony was clear, unflinching, and devastating. Edgar testified again, too. Onlookers were floored by what he said. "Yep," he testified, "I did it. And also, I killed Vicky Zielinski, too. It had happened just as prosecutors said it had. He'd offered her a ride, then cornered her in the sandpit and demanded sex. She had refused. He had killed her for it. He said he couldn't help it. He was a sexual predator and he had kidnapped both women with the intent to rape them." This might seem like taking ownership, but it really wasn't. See, in California at the time, kidnapping with the intent to rob carried a heftier potential sentence than kidnapping with intent to rape. If you kidnapped to rape, you'd get the possibility of parole. Kidnapped to rob, and parole was off the table. As Lisa Osboon testified, Edgar had told her repeatedly during her assault that he was going to rob her. So he had to work against his own words and try to say that actually his crime was sexually motivated, not monetarily motivated. And to bolster that argument, he tried to establish a pattern by confessing what he had done to Vicky.
He basically tries to manufacture a defense that he's a mentally disordered sex offender, and that's what caused him to go after Lisa.
Edgar said, quote, "For the first time in my life, I recognized that the devil I had been looking at the last 43 years was me. I recognized what I am, and I admitted it," end quote. In his piece about the verdict, Joe Piccioni wrote that he hoped William F. Buckley wasn't feeling too great about it. Hey everyone, before we get back to the show, just a reminder that you can get bonus episodes and bonus material at grabbagcollab.com. Just go to grabbagcollab.com and choose which tier you'd like to subscribe to. Thanks so much. The second time Edgar Smith was tried, there was no jury present. He opted to have his case heard only by a judge, apparently thinking he would have better luck convincing one lawman rather than 12 lay people. He was wrong. Edgar Smith was convicted of attempted murder and kidnapping with intent to rob. He was sentenced to life in prison. This time, there would be no appeals that succeeded, no overturned convictions, no William F. Buckley waiting outside the courthouse with champagne. A New York Daily News reporter tracked down Vicky's father, Anthony Zielinski, who said the previous decade plus had been torture as he listened to people championing the man who he was certain killed his daughter. Anthony said, quote, "I hope the judge out there rides him right to the electric chair because that's where he belongs," end quote. I imagine he didn't care much for William F. Buckley, who, it should be noted, was on the defensive. In 1977, he got a letter from a man in Newark, New Jersey, questioning his decision to back Edgar. Edward Fitzpatrick wrote, quote, "This letter is not to offer an I told you so, but to suggest that you give serious consideration to offering an apology to the living victims of your friend and cause celeb, Mr. Smith. You should not forget that it was your perverted sense of justice which set in motion the events which eventually freed Mr. Smith to commit another violent crime," end quote. Buckley responded in an article headlined "The Edgar Smith Case Act 3. He dodged the apology question altogether and instead said some gobbledygook about how it should have always been a second-degree murder conviction anyway because Edgar surely didn't plan the murder beforehand. In 1979, Life magazine commissioned Buckley to write a piece on the case's aftermath. Surely at this point, he had had some time to really process what had happened.
So that's when you would think that he would be wrestling with this. Not really, because he basically is like, yeah, Edgar tried to kill someone else, but how could we have known? And, you know, essentially washing his hands of any responsibility.
He painted himself as a victim, said he had been fooled by Edgar's social savvy and wit. He didn't dwell on the fact that he had used his enormous platform, his wealth, and his connections to free a man who went on to stab a woman and leave her for dead, or that he backed a cause based on his belief in Edgar's intellectual capabilities rather than a thorough examination of the evidence. He was swayed by class bias, the idea that an articulate, well-read man couldn't possibly be a brutal killer.
This article definitely gets Edgar's goat. He writes some pretty vituperative things both to Buckley and also to his ex-wife.
After 1979, Buckley moved on. And because of who he was, founder of the National Review, host of Firing Line, one of the most influential conservative intellectuals in America, he could afford to move on. He continued writing, speaking, and influencing American political thought. His reputation recovered. The Edgar Smith episode became a footnote in Buckley's legacy, an embarrassing mistake, but not a defining one. For Lisa Osboon and Victoria Zelinsky's family, there were no such footnotes. Buckley did write one letter to Sophie Wilkins that's worth noting. By this point, the two of them had developed a genuine friendship, independent of Edgar, forged through the strange, traumatic experience of being manipulated by the same man. Sarah Weinman describes them as acting like survivors of a shared war. In that letter, Buckley referenced the case of Norman Mailer and Jack Henry Abbott. Mailer, another prominent literary figure, had championed Abbott, another articulate prisoner who wrote beautifully about prison life. Mailer had helped get Abbott released from prison in 1981. Just weeks after his release, Abbott murdered a waiter named Richard Aiden in New York City. The parallels were obvious and uncomfortable. Buckley's line to Sophie about Edgar, quote, "At least ours had the decency to wait a few years and to botch the job," end quote. Lisa Osboon had survived. That was something. Edgar Smith remained in prison for the rest of his life. He did have parole hearings, though, despite his initial sentence, because of a law change that could be applied retroactively. He contested his sentence through the courts in the 1980s and 1990s, filing appeal after appeal, but this time they went nowhere. He was just another prisoner serving life for a violent crime. His health deteriorated in custody. He suffered multiple heart attacks. He grew old in prison. Whenever he came up for parole, the possibility sparked immediate protests from Lisa Osboon, from the original prosecutor's son, from victims' advocates, and from anyone who remembered what he had done. He was denied. Edgar Herbert Smith Jr. died on March 20th, 2017, at California Medical Center in Vacaville. He was 83 years old. He had spent the last 40 years of his life in California prisons, nearly three times as long as he had spent on death row in New Jersey. It took the media 6 months to notice that he had died. The Washington Post finally reported it in September 2017. The New York Times followed. This was a far cry from 1957, when the Bergen Record had put Vicky's body on the front page, or from 1971, when Edgar's release had been covered by national television news. By 2017, Edgar Smith was a footnote, just an old man who had died in prison. Nobody cared anymore. Sophie Wilkins eventually divorced and finally found the love of her life. They spent her remaining years together. She maintained her friendship with William F. Buckley until she died. Before that, Sophie had packed up her papers to donate them to Columbia University. She didn't sift through them first. She either didn't remember what was in those letters from Edgar, or she chose not to remember. The explicit correspondence, the inappropriate intimacy, maybe it was too painful to revisit. Or maybe, after all those years, it had simply faded from her memory as something that had happened to a different version of herself. Pat Smith, Edgar's first wife, the mother of his daughter Patricia, built a new life in Colorado. She remarried and never looked back. When investigators occasionally tried to contact her about the case over the years, she wanted nothing to do with it. She had moved on. Lisa Osboon moved on from her harrowing attack as best she could, too. She lived until 2019. Paige, Edgar's second wife, is still alive. She declined to cooperate with Weinman's book, but said she was relieved to learn when Edgar died. And they're all victims in this story, but of course, they're not alone.
The person who really got lost is Victoria Zelinsky, because she never had a chance to make anything of her life. We don't know. All we can do is suppose. But when you're 15, you can be anything, but you can also be nothing. We don't know, because Edgar Smith took that away from her and from her family and community and from the rest of us.
Vicky was, by all accounts, a sweet and studious kid who was just starting to find her footing. She was on the honor roll. She was learning German. She liked to go roller skating on Friday nights. She was close with her younger sister, Myrna. She was just starting to come into her own. Edgar Smith took all of that away. And then he convinced some of the most intelligent people in America that he hadn't done it. And then he tried to do it again. The Edgar Smith case became a cautionary tale, but not in the way William F. Buckley might have hoped for back in 1965 when he first read about the National Review fan behind bars. Instead of it being a story about a wrongfully convicted man and his fight for freedom, it's a cautionary tale about how intelligent people can be manipulated by someone who knows how to write, how to mirror, and how to become whatever his audience wants him to be. About how class bias and eloquence can override evidence. Edgar Smith got multiple books, national media attention, elite lawyers, and a second chance at freedom. How many truly innocent people, less articulate, less well-connected, less able to charm editors and intellectuals, remain in prison right now with no William F. Buckley to champion their cause? Some people truly deserve second chances. Of course, Victoria Zelinsky never had a shot at one. And that's the real crime of the century. To research this case, I relied on Sarah Weinman's excellent book, Scoundrel, How a Convicted Murderer Persuaded the Women Who Loved Him, the Conservative Establishment, and the Courts to Set Him Free, which I do highly recommend. Special thanks to Sarah for agreeing to an interview. I also reviewed contemporary newspaper coverage from the Bergen Record, Patterson Evening News, New York Times, and other sources, watched archival Firing Line episodes featuring Edgar Smith, and consulted court records and legal filings from both Edgar's New Jersey and California cases. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.